The Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas. All persons having business before the Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas, are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the state of Texas and this honorable court.
Thank you. Please be seated. We have one case on our docket. It is N. Ray Ann Marie Forlenza, original mandamus petition. We've allotted 20 minutes for each side to present oral argument. The relator may reserve a portion of that time for rebuttal. These arguments are being recorded at the court's convenience by the clerk's office, and you may purchase a tape of the argument for a nominal fee from the clerk. We're ready to hear argument from the relator.
Please support Mr. Brad Lamorius to present argument for the relator.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, my name is Brad Lamorgis, and I represent Ann Forlenza. The position I advocate today is supported by basic legal principles of fairness. Number one, Ms. Forlenza's position is supported by the code commentary that we've cited to the court, which I'll read again because I think it's crucial. The code commentary to section 152.202 states that jurisdiction attaches at the commencement of a proceeding. If state A had jurisdiction under this section at the time a modification proceeding was commenced there, it would not be lost by all parties moving out of the state prior to the conclusion of the proceeding. State B would not have jurisdiction to hear a modification unless state A decided state B was more appropriate under section 207, which is in convenient form. And here the trial court made a determination that the form was not inconvenient. Ms. Forlenza's position is also supported by Texas Family Code section 152.107, mandating priority for jurisdictional disputes and directing that they be handled expeditiously. Ms. Forlenza's position also avoids judicial sampling and wasting of resources.
Let me ask you some questions about the record. When the children were in Texas prior to the time that the motion to modify was filed, how long were those visits?
The visits typically, because they were interstate, my understanding is that they were longer than weekends. It would be, you know, several weeks during the summer. One of the children, I believe it's the oldest child, has year-round school. I don't believe that appears in the record, but that those visits couldn't be as long as it would be under the regular standard possession order. So I think that's one of the reasons why this modification.
Does the record reflect how many days, during set time periods, the children would be in Texas?
I don't think it reflected the duration of the visits. I don't think the record reflects that.
You argue in your brief that the father was responsible for denial of visitation and was made it hard to have contact with the children in Texas. What does the record show about that?
I believe the record shows that several motions were filed in regard to denial of visitation, and I think that appears in Ms. Forlenza's testimony, which is in Volume 3 of the record, the very beginning of it.
Factually, what does the record show about?
The record shows Ms. Forlenza testified that was one of the reasons she filed this modification petition, was because Mr. Forlenza was making it difficult for her to visit.
And what was he doing to make it difficult?
I don't think that was reflected in the record. And so the record also, I think, reflected that during the proceeding there were some disagreements over the holiday visitation that was going to take place, so several hearings were held with regard to that, and that does appear in the record. I believe that was Volume 3 as well.
What is 152.202A1, when it says substantial evidence is no longer available, is there any case law that sort of interprets what quantum of evidence is necessary to be substantial under that section? In other words, the parties have briefed it almost as a minimum context sort of analysis, but the statute actually says substantial evidence concerning the child's care, protection, training, and personal relationships. And it strikes me, if you've got a parent here, that alone could be substantial evidence about the child's care and protection. But I haven't seen any case law on what quantum of proof is needed.
And I think that's one of the problems we have here, is that it isn't well defined. The statute being enacted in 1999 has, I think, but there was one case.
It's a uniform act. And I do you know how many states have adopted it?
I think the code commentary said somewhere around 32 or somewhere.
And do you know if any of those courts have interpreted that term substantial evidence?
I did not see many cases in my search on that, because the statute is fairly recent in almost all of those states. And so this, the UCCJEA, sort of emanated from Texas, and so other states have also adopted that.
Can one spouse's residence in Texas affect either prong, either the significant connection or the substantial evidence?
That's a difficult question, because the statute itself provides that if all parents leave the state, then jurisdiction will probably leave as well to go where the children are.
Probably.
So,
why probably?
Well, because it seems that the statute, quite candidly, would require something more than just residence. And in this case, I think we do have that something more.
But it's everybody left. Surely Texas has no continuing jurisdiction.
That's correct.
But does one what effect does one spouse being here have? If you can consider it, looks to me like it would always be pretty significant. And if you can't, then what are we left with?
Well, I think in this case it's particularly significant. I can think of an example. If one spouse wholly didn't exercise their possession, there were completely no evidence in Texas, and sort of one of the spouses went off and did their own thing and really didn't ever have any contact with the family again, that may be a situation where jurisdiction would leave. I don't think that's the case here, and I think Ms. Valenza's presence is a significant tie to the state.
But wouldn't it always be, and then so you would always win? Whoever was in Texas would always win.
I don't think that would always be the case.
Well, what? I'm trying to help me. When would it not be? Looks to me like it would always be, because there would always be some significance, some visits, some trips to the doctor, some friends, some playing with the neighbors, and so you would always win if you were in Texas. Or any other state, for that matter.
Under the normal circumstances, I think that would be correct, that Texas would retain jurisdiction. There have been cases I've personally seen where one spouse will move off and then sort of no longer take an interest, maybe not pay child support, maybe not do the visitation. And in that case, it seems like that spouse resided in Texas and stayed in the divorce jurisdiction. The one who wasn't visiting, who wasn't fulfilling their duties, then the evidence or the would become so attenuated, the contacts, that there would no longer be jurisdiction.
Here we don't have much more than visitation, do we? I mean, if the visitation had been half of what it turned out to be in this case, would that be enough for a significant connection? If one of the parents remained in the divorce jurisdiction, I'm trying to get at a level of when there is a significant connection.
So that's a hard question.
Well, that's why I'm asking it to you.
In this case, when you have enough evidence of the children visiting, and I think part of the problem here was the denial of visitation, which was why this was filed, that things were becoming very difficult to visit. But when we're talking about regular visits, we're talking about evidence of people with knowledge of relevant facts, as in this case, there were a lot of Texas residents.
But the children don't live here. They haven't for a long time.
That's correct.
And so I'm just trying to understand, if you, Judge O'Neill, ask if you know any authority. If you don't, what is your view of when there is enough? 2 visits a year? 1 visit a year, 3 days a year, when is there enough for there to be a significant connection if a parent resides in the divorce state?
Well, I think that several visits would be enough. if there's other information, you know, in this case, the children were going to church here when they were here. They did visit the doctor here. So we're talking about evidence building up. In an interstate case, it's difficult to exercise standard possession every other weekend. As a practical matter, that never happens. And so the big visitation usually comes during the summer and then maybe break times. And so if you have that sort of exercise going on, I think that visitation or the jurisdiction would stay here. When we're talking about very, very young children, it may at some point, if those visits don't occur, if these things aren't occurring, it could leave the state. I don't know that there's a bright line there. I just don't know. But if we're talking about a regular parent who's interested, who's attempting to exercise at the very least, or actually exercising, I think jurisdiction would stay because there is that significant connection.
Wouldn't it depend on what the question is in the motion to modify? I mean, if the question is, I want to move the children to Taiwan, then the question is, how close are the children, how much do the children then needing their mother? The question is whether dad's child support ought to increase, and you're going to have different witnesses in that hearing, aren't you?
Well, child support is treated a little differently because
I'm
that's
sorry,
based on personal.
Something else, like some other aspect of the visitation.
I think we would, our position, we would generally agree with that. The jurisdiction here is not evaluated in a vacuum. You're going to be looking at that as a relative term. In other words, when you look at what Texas's ties are to the litigation, significant ties or substantial evidence, I think you also should look at it in consideration of what other state jurisdiction would go to or where jurisdiction would go to and that state's ties.
But I mean, if the question is we're going to move the children to Taiwan so dad can make twice as much money, and if the evidence is going to be mom sees them a couple of weeks a year and majority of the time she flies to see them, not they fly to see her, then we're probably not going to have some doctor from Dallas and the youth pastor from the church testify because they're not really involved. We're not talking about are the children being abused or anything like that.
Well, there may be, each case obviously different, but those witnesses may have something to say about mother's relationship.
The substantial evidence is going to depend on what the question, underlying question is in the modification, isn't it?
I think so.
Would it make any difference in this case, take all the same facts, except that the girls had not moved? They'd gone to one state and lived there the whole time. Would that make a difference?
I think that probably would make more of a difference.
Why does it make any difference whether the children's contacts with Texas are significant, depending on whether they resided in one other state, two other states, five other states?
I'll qualify that with I don't think it would change the result in this case. It would make it a more difficult case. In this case, I think we still do, especially in relation to the other states involved in this proceeding, have a very significant Texas tie in that the mother has remained here, has done the visitation here, has taken the children to church here, and Texas is ready to try this case. I think also...
I just don't see in the statute where any of that makes any difference. What difference does it make that Texas is ready to try the case under 152.202A1?
Well, where that position is supported by is the code commentary that jurisdiction attaches at the commencement. And so we don't have the record from the first motion to dismiss hearing, and appellate review, mandamus review, which would have been appropriate, was not sought. And so at that point, I think, and the code actually defines commencement as the filing of the first pleading in a proceeding, and that's 152.102 under the definition section. So when we're talking about something that was not filed at the beginning of the proceeding, but near the very end, then if multiple filings are indeed permissible, then what evidence may the court consider? And I think we would advocate if multiple filings are permissible, which we don't agree with, then we're not going to make this determination in a vacuum. We're going to look at what evidence is accumulated up to the date of the filing of the motion.
I don't see how that makes any sense. You're going to determine it as of the date it was filed based on evidence that has occurred since.
Well, up to the date of the filing of the motion, if we're talking about multiple filings being permissible.
Well,
because
I understood your position at the outset to be you must determine jurisdiction as of the date of the filing of the proceeding. It's not your position.
Well, jurisdiction needs to be determined at the commencement. I think that's our position.
Of the proceeding?
Yes.
Well, how can you consider evidence that arose after that?
Well, if multiple filings are permissible, which we disagree with, we do agree jurisdiction attaches at the commencement. But if multiple filings are permissible, then the court ought to not evaluate the exact same evidence that already evaluated. That doesn't make sense in our opinion. If you're going to have a trial eve motion to dismiss, then we ought to not look at it in a vacuum. We ought to look at what's occurred during, you know, the money the parties have spent, who they've hired, what evidence is accumulated.
Counsel, neither side has made much of a point of the agreed modification order that originally gave the father the exclusive right to establish the child's or the children's primary physical residence. Is that just not significant here, and if not, why?
Well, I think it was...
I mean, it's been mentioned in the briefs, but no significant argument made by either side about that.
I think it was significant in that that was one of the reasons, as the record shows, why the motion to modify was filed and why an injunction was put in place, because it wasn't crystal clear whether one party would be able to move out of the country with the children. So I think that was significant beginning.
But do you think that should carry any significance with the court today?
I don't think that affects the jurisdiction standard. I don't think the two are related, I guess.
Does the record reflect why that agreement was entered into at that point in time?
I don't believe so.
Is there a burden of proof issue in the statute? I mean, does it presume jurisdiction where the original order was signed unless someone can overcome that presumption? And if that's, I mean, and if your answer is yes, are we just presuming that from the language of the statute, or is there any authority that's burden shifting under this?
I've found no authority on who bears the burden, and I don't think the statute's very clear on that. I think traditionally the movement would bear the burden, and so I think that's the burden in this case because the default is continuing exclusive jurisdiction.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from the real party.
May it please the court, Mr. Charles Robinson will present argument to the respondent.
Mr. Chief Justice of the court, may it please the court. I'm Charles H. Robertson. I represent Robert Valenza, co-counsel of Sharon Freitag, who's responsible for most of the briefing that has been done on behalf of our client. I'd like to speak immediately to some of the questions that the court has asked, Mr. Lamorges. First, I think there's a basic misunderstanding of the concept of continuing jurisdiction. Continuing jurisdiction came into Texas family law with the passage of Title II of the Family Code, which became effective January 1st, 1974. The problem up to that point was that people who moved around our state with 254 counties wouldn't know where to file a proceeding if they had moved from the county in which the case was originally decided. And so the concept of continuing jurisdiction came into existence, which created what the law professors thought of as a mother court. So you always have to go back to the mother court to file a pleading irrespective of what you want. Now, you may file a pleading in the mother court that says, we need a modification, and because no one lives in this county, it needs to be transferred to another county. At that point in time, the UCCJA, which was passed in 1960, really didn't have a concept of continuing jurisdiction. we were fortunate in Texas in that we had so much influence over what happened in the UCCJA because of the reporter and one of the commissioners are well-known Texas lawyers. The concept of continuing jurisdiction came into existence in the UCCJEA because of a conflict that existed between the UCCJA and the PKPA, which is the Parental Kidnapping Prevention Act. There were disputes with respect to which state, in which state you could file a proceeding under the UCCJA, and the Parental Kidnapping Prevention Act created preference for home state, prioritized home state. And the states had to pass a law which conformed to the federal law, which was the PKPA. So that the principal difference between the UCCJEA and the UCCJA is that this concept of mother court was taken from Texas to this new statute, which is a uniform law, which has been passed by about 34 states. The concept is virtually identical. You have to go back to the court in the state that initially made the determination. And that continuing jurisdiction is an unusual kind of jurisdiction. It's the jurisdiction that allows you to go into that court for purposes of determining whether that court is the proper place thereafter.
Okay, so they went to the original court for that determination under 152.202.
Correct.
Isn't it true that there are implied findings by the trial court that there was a significant connection with the state and there was substantial evidence of the child's care, protection, training, and personal relationships as it pertains to the state of Texas? Weren't there implied findings?
I think not, Your Honor.
Why not? Because there's evidence on each of those issues presented to the trial
court. Okay, the facts are undisputed, and there is no evidence, either in the pleadings, and there's a requirement on the plaintiff's behalf that they put into evidence in their pleadings allegations that support jurisdiction. And simply alleging that you have continuing jurisdiction because that's the court that decided the case initially isn't sufficient.
There are two comments, the commissioner's comments I want to ask you about. They seem to imply at least that in construing this, we look at the contact between the parent who still lives in the mother state, as you call it, and the child. At one place in paragraph one, it says, if the relationship between the child and the person remaining in the state with exclusive continuing jurisdiction has become so attenuated that the court could no longer find significant connections and substantial evidence, jurisdiction would no longer exist. It seems to me like, what if the mother lives in Texas and she flies every other weekend over a period of 5 or 6 years to visit the children in Georgia? And the children never come to Texas. Would the court of continuing jurisdiction have lost jurisdiction simply because the contacts took place outside the state?
I think yes, they would have, and that's not only dependent upon the Texas cases, but an analysis of 63 other UCCJEA cases from other states in addition to the Texas cases. The problem is that there are ways that you could have significant contact even though the parent is in Texas and the children are somewhere else, and that simply wasn't done. And
my example is you do have. She flies every other weekend, and then they come for Christmas holidays.
If, in fact, that were the case, I think you could consider that. That wasn't the case here. There were 5 visits in 4 years in Texas.
How long were those visits?
The record doesn't reflect how long they were, but they were not lengthy visits. There were visits, I think, a week, 10 days, maybe 2 weeks at the most, one summer.
There's another piece of the comment. It's in the paragraph 2 or the second comment. It talks about the difference between the PKPA and this act, and it seems to say that you can't have just the fact that a grandparent remains in the state won't have continuing jurisdiction, but it seems to say that significant connection between the original state and the parent and the child, that would suffice. It doesn't necessarily imply in these comments that the child has to come to Texas as long as one parent who lives in Texas maintain significant contact with the child.
You know what the statute actually says. It says that...
I'm just asking about the comments now.
Well, the comments, I don't think fully contemplate the facts of this case. And if you look at the statute says that neither the child, comma, nor the child and the parent, comma, nor a person acting as a parent. And that wasn't the case in this. There was no person acting as a parent. The comments also say that mere physical presence of one party left in the state isn't sufficient to establish a significant connection or substantial evidence. that priority is given.
Is it to be taken into consideration, and if so, how?
Well, judgment, the significant connection test and the substantial evidence requirement are conjunctive, so you can't separate them. It has to be both. It can't be one. And so if you look at the significant connection, then you say, what does that mean? The UCCJA, the one thing that was a continuum from the UCCJA to the UCCJEA is the definition of significant connection and substantial evidence. So counsel's comment in the brief that the UCCJA isn't relevant is a mistake. So we have cases for since 1960 that talk about what a significant connection is and what substantial evidence is. Now in Texas, since the UCCJEA, we have several cases. And the problem is, we know what a significant connection is.
Well, then tell me what it is.
Okay.
I'm not sure.
What it is a case similar to that in Bellamy.
In the Bellamy. Oh, in Bellamy.
Bellamy. In the Bellamy case.
Well, a Bellamy, I'm sorry, I don't mean, but I mean, a Bellamy case is an example where they found it. But
that's
they
right.
Said that quantum, I mean, how often are you going to have a child who crosses the border to go to school every day? And I, holding that up as the paradigm of what's necessary for significant connection, did the court ever say you need this type of connection
no.
to be significant?
It's not a paradigm. What it is, it establishes parameters.
Well, it doesn't say that that's the, it just says under those facts.
Yeah.
That it doesn't say that's the, anything less than this would not be. And again, going back to my
what
question.
It says on CCB versus MJB, Judge, is it says specifically that, you know, it talks about development. Then it said these are the types of contacts that might cause a Texas court to retain subject matter jurisdiction. Now, that's a case that followed Bellamy. That's a case out of the El Paso Court of Appeals. You know, the way I research these questions is the first thing I do is go and type in Ann McClure, and if she's written anything on it, it's probably right.
Well, let me ask you this. There was a motion, the same type motion was filed earlier in the modification proceeding, saying that Texas was not the right place to bring this. It should be in Virginia. Let's say the trial court had found, had granted father's motion to dismiss then. Mom goes to Virginia and files it in Virginia right after the dismissal is signed. Proceedings start in Virginia. Dad moves to Colorado. A motion to dismiss would be presumably granted in Virginia.
No, Your Honor.
What's it, but, okay, if it's not, then you've got parties from Colorado and Texas going to Virginia that now has no relationship.
Well,
help me with that. Scenario.
Okay, first of all, Judge, the suggestion that there were duplicate motions filed is just simply incorrect.
The father did not file a motion to dismiss.
The first motion to dismiss was filed under Section 152.201, and I wasn't the attorney. And a non-family lawyer filed a motion to dismiss saying that the Texas court didn't have original jurisdiction to file a custody action.
Because?
First of all, it wasn't an original action for custody. And so Judge Henderson looked at it and said, well, you know, I kind of agree that he dismissed that because he said, this is a modification. You're asking me to dismiss this case based on the fact that we don't have jurisdiction to file an original action. This isn't an original action. And so the motion that we filed January 27, 2002 to dismiss the case because of lack of subject matter jurisdiction was a totally different motion. The only similarity was the U words motion to dismiss were in both. The first was ill-conceived and incorrectly filed, and the judge properly did what he did with respect to that motion.
Well, presume it had been properly filed. Presume that the evidence was the same as it is here now, that the children had been in Virginia for 2.5 years and it should have been dismissed on that basis. Because I presume if you had brought this motion at that point, it, the same argument would apply that you're making here today. It would have been dismissible back then.
Well, Judge, if on the seminal date is September 10, 2001, and it's kind of like being prayed, you are or not, and the court did or didn't have subject matter jurisdiction on September 10, 2001. You can't go past September 10, 2001 to decide. You can only look back. And if there had been a motion filed to dismiss and had been granted, and she had gone to Virginia, it wouldn't have mattered whether he'd gone to Colorado or not, because Virginia would have been the home state until the children had lived in Colorado for 6 months. And so she could have filed in Virginia, and that would have been where it was held.
But now, I thought under your analysis, once they've got 6 months home state in another state, that divests the court of jurisdiction.
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. Judge, home state's important because when you have a modification, the process the court goes through to determine whether or not they have subject matter jurisdiction is, like, first of all, is there a home state in Texas? And if there is, shut out the lights, the party's over. Texas has jurisdiction. If Texas isn't the home state, Virginia's the home state, then you have to look to the other possible bases for subject matter jurisdiction. And the only one that exists in this case is that you have to have significant connection and substantial evidence at the time of the filing of the motion, September 10, 2001.
But wouldn't they lose jurisdiction under the plain meaning of the statute? They would lose jurisdiction in Virginia once both parents and children no longer lived in Virginia. I mean, once they've been in Colorado for 6 months, unless you've got get to trial within the 6 month period, it seems like they lose jurisdiction.
Well, if you filed in Virginia within the 6 months of the time that the case was dismissed for want of jurisdiction in Texas, the case would stay in Virginia irrespective of when they moved to Colorado or how long they'd been there.
Well, this says that once the statute says, even that court loses jurisdiction.
I think you misread it. That's not what the statute says. The statute is that once you've established a home state and filed in a home state, or you filed in the home state within 6 months of the time the parties left that home state, that state still has jurisdiction.
So that would be an original proceeding, not a...
That's correct.
Okay.
In a modification proceeding, you know, you have jurisdiction. There's not a different standard. On a modification proceeding, you simply cannot modify the order of another state unless that state has found that they no longer have subject matter jurisdiction or both parents have left that state. And we're not really talking about modification jurisdiction under 152.203. We're really talking about jurisdiction under 152.202. And the reality is that if you look at the evidence, first if you look at the pleadings, let me run that by real quick. There were no allegations in the pleadings of significant connection or substantial evidence in Texas. The lawyer who filed the suit knew Virginia was the home state. The lawyer in Texas...
Was there any special exception?
There weren't any special exceptions, Your Honor. Like I say, I'm the third attorney, and I don't know why the lawyer did or didn't do what she did. But
normally, if we were going to toss them out because their pleadings were insufficiently specific, somebody would have to file a special exception.
Well, unless there's a burden on the person who's making the pleading, and if there's a burden on the person who's doing the pleading, for example, Judge, they're required. It says shall in the statute, 152.209. The party who files a modification at the time of the filing or in an affidavit attached thereto has to set out the place of residences of the children for the preceding 5 years. That's not discretionary. That's mandatory.
And if they don't, the appellate court, when that's pointed out on appeal, should dismiss the case?
No. It doesn't cause you to lose jurisdiction. But what it does, Judge, is it should color the decision of the court in that the person who has the obligation to provide the information that would tell the trial court judge who has the obligation, if he thinks there's not subject matter jurisdiction, he has that obligation to dismiss it whether there's a motion filed or not. And what the party's doing when they file that without providing that information to him is, whether it's through ignorance or deceit, they're misleading the trial court judge.
But then there was evidence presented, and I want to just get back to my question before, because I just don't quite understand it, and maybe you can explain it to me. How do you support your argument that there is no evidence to support either of those factors when there, I mean, at a minimum, there was evidence of the visitations in Texas of the children to the mother. There's evidence of prescriptions. We might consider that to be meager or not a whole lot of evidence, but of some evidence. There are friends in Texas. There were relationships. The witnesses were from Texas. How is that not some evidence of a connection to Texas or some substantial interest?
It certainly is evidence, some evidence, but it's not substantial evidence. And what the code requires is that you have the significant connection and that you have substantial evidence. And the code says specifically in the commentary that you're to maximize, not minimize, the possibility of evidence being available. The code, UCCJEA, specifically says we're prioritizing, you know, the child, not the parent left behind. And so the substantial connection, substantial evidence, is evidence relating specifically to the child. And if you look, Judge, at their pleadings, their pleadings contain no allegations of that whatsoever. And I'd like to call to your attention just real quickly.
Is the maximized language in the UCCJEA or the UCCJA?
UCCJEA in the comments to it.
Where?
Well, it's also in the cases.
Where is it in the comments?
Judge, the comments are long, and I can't tell you under which particular section, but I can tell you that the cases say that, and not just the Texas cases, but the cases from other states. And if I could just give you a vignette of what happened at the trial. The question is, that, and this is from the transcript, Reporters Volume 2, page 116, line 1. Is there anything in your motion to modify where you talk about the contacts the girls have had with the state of Texas since July 1997? You mean other than my address? Other than your address? No, there is nothing in there.
Do you think the statute contemplates that there will be some place that has significant connection and substantial evidence?
I think so, Judge. I think you look for significant connection. You say, where have they lived? How long have they lived there?
Just one state. I mean, there's five possible states here, so there's going to be one right and four wrong?
No. You look at the state in which the children currently live, and you say, and that was Virginia, the time the motion was filed. You say, how long have they been here? Been here 3.5 years. How long have they gone to school here? Yes. Have gone to doctors here? Yes. They go to church here? They have friends here?
But it doesn't say most significant. It doesn't say most substantial. It just says substantial. It doesn't seem to say to pick the best. I mean, that's where I'm having trouble with your statement.
Well, I think, Judge, the kind of context, the evidence that's available in Texas is de minimis. And that's obvious if you look at what Ms. Forlenza said.
But if it's de minimis several places, then do you compare, or what do you do?
Well, if it's the first thing you do, Judge, you say, do they have a home state? And if they have a home state, then you look to see whether or not there's a significant connection and substantial evidence in the home state of the children. And part of the analysis is you also look to see if
it's kind of hard to imagine that you wouldn't have.
That's typically why, if you look at all the cases that have ever been decided under the UCCJA and JEA, there's not a single case counsel can cite you from any jurisdiction when the kids have been gone 5 years that the state retained subject matter jurisdiction over the case. There isn't one.
But under your scenario, someone could move every 6 months and he'd really evade any sort of modification, couldn't he?
And that's not Mr. Forlenza.
I'm not. I didn't mean to posit that it was.
No, I think not, Your Honor. I think that, all you have to do is catch them, if they move.
But you're playing catch.
If they move tomorrow. No, you're really not. If they move tomorrow to Alaska and you file suit in Texas day after tomorrow, Texas is the home state because it's a state in which they live 6 months prior to the time you file. There would be no other home state. Alaska wouldn't be their home state. And because then you get to the analysis comparatively, and you say, well, should Texas exercise jurisdiction over a situation like that? And the answer is absolutely yes.
But, so you file the modification, and it sits there for 6 months. It's set for trial 8 months. Oops, there's now a new home state. So, as long as you could file it and get it heard and decided within 6 months, you're not playing catch.
Judge, it doesn't matter that there's a new home state. The fact that these children live in Colorado is simply a fact that has nothing whatsoever to do with your determination of whether the court had subject matter jurisdiction. The fact is that Virginia is the home state. And, any other move is irrelevant for purposes of your consideration. The reality is the only thing you look to.
So what you're arguing, this should be in Virginia, not Colorado?
At the time of the filing, September 10th, 2001.
No, I'm saying if this case were dismissed, where should Mom file the modification right now?
Well, Judge Henderson said in his opinion that Colorado was the home state. And so
I thought you said home state didn't matter. Else you could be in a situation where you're trying to play catch.
Well, if the case was dismissed for want of subject matter jurisdiction in Texas, and if she knows the children have been in the home in Colorado for 6 months, and the judge has said that's their home state, it would be foolish for her to file in Virginia.
Well, no, but if we say the trial court erred in not dismissing it, your argument was that at the time the trial court ruled, the appropriate place would have been Virginia.
That's correct. And now, Judge, if it's dismissed, the proper place would be Colorado.
I still come back to 201. She had filed in Virginia, and then the children had moved to Colorado, this 201A1 says that the Virginia court can't keep it because she doesn't live there. No, there's no parent or person acting as a parent that continues to live in Virginia. So how do you...
Judge, you're looking at the wrong statute. 201 is not the statute you would look at. That's an original
I thought you told me a minute ago what she should have done was to file in Virginia originally. And then you said it would be an original...
No, you misunderstood.
You said that would be initial custody.
No.
Okay, so let's...
Anytime there's a mother court, you have to go back... You have to come back to Texas. And so 201 is essentially irrelevant for purposes of
our... Okay, let's say Judge Henderson is dismissed under 201. Under 202, says, I no longer have jurisdiction, Mom, go to Virginia. Mother goes to Virginia, then the father takes the children and moves them out. When she goes to Virginia, is that governed by 201 or 202?
202. It's not an initial child custody determination. It's a modification of
but
an existing
once,
order.
But once she doesn't live there, the children no longer live there, the father no longer lives there, how can that court under 202, it explicitly states once they all leave, it doesn't have continuing jurisdiction.
No, it states when they all leave Texas. Texas no longer has continuing jurisdiction.
They're in Virginia now. The Texas case has been dismissed. Judge Henderson said, I don't have continuing jurisdiction anymore. So the mother goes to Virginia, files. The dad takes the kids, moves to Colorado. Under 202, Virginia loses jurisdiction.
I disagree, Your Honor. Virginia would not lose jurisdiction if she filed while he and the children were in Virginia or within 6 months after the date they left Virginia.
But as soon as they move, it says you lose continuing jurisdiction if the parent and the children no longer live in the state.
Judge, that's for purposes of if you have a Texas action, and Mr. Forlenza moves to Virginia and Ms. Forlenza moves to Arkansas.
I'm telling you, please listen carefully.
Okay.
She files in Texas, like she's supposed to. The judge dismisses, says, I no longer have continuing jurisdiction. So then she goes to Virginia. The Virginia court begins the proceeding, and the father takes the children and moves to Colorado. Then there's no longer a parent or a child living in Virginia. It seems to me under 202, the Virginia court no longer has continuing jurisdiction.
That's incorrect.
Why?
Jurisdiction would have already attached. And once jurisdiction attaches, irrespective of where he goes with the children, that court would have jurisdiction.
For how long? 10 years? 5 years?
Until such time as that action was concluded.
And where does the statute say that?
Judge, it's kind of like asking me, why are most barns red? You know, I've worked with this and dealt with this so much that I know that's right. I know that there are cases that support that.
We need
that.
Some language in the statute. I'm just trying to go by what the statute says. The statute says you lose jurisdiction.
Okay, specifically which provision are you looking at?
You said 202 would govern under those facts.
202 is modification. 203 is modification of an order of another state. So if you're talking about coming to Texas, 202 is the statute you have to look to. If you talk about going to Virginia to modify a Texas order, you have to look at 203.
And does 203 say once you get it filed there, they don't lose jurisdiction until they make the determination?
They prioritize home state and contacts. In that situation, as you described, Your Honor, with their having been there for 3 years, going to school there, going to doctors there, there would no doubt be substantial evidence. There would be significant connection and substantial evidence in Virginia. And the Virginia court, if they rule properly, would maintain jurisdiction over the action.
Okay, and so they've moved to Colorado, and you've got mom and dad and kids flying from Colorado and Texas to Virginia to determine the modification.
Yep. Judge, I understand there may be logistical problems, but the reality is that the question before the court is, on September 10, 2001, did Texas have subject matter jurisdiction? And those inquiries are interesting, and we can discuss those and have different theories about what should happen, but that's not the question before the court.
Let me ask you the basic question. You keep saying subject matter jurisdiction. It seems like these provisions more in the nature of like personal jurisdiction or venue. Where does it say subject matter jurisdiction? Is that how all the case law treats it?
Well, there's...
I'm reading it. It says jurisdiction.
There's a confusion between substantive issues such as right to visitation and things like that and subject matter jurisdiction. In subject matter jurisdiction of the power of the court to hear the particular controversy, and that's dependent upon the significant connection and the substantial evidence at the time of the filing of the suit. And personal jurisdiction really doesn't play a part in it. Best interest of the child doesn't play a part in it. You know, under the...
Well, let me ask you this then. Can this subject matter jurisdiction be waived?
Absolutely not. You know, Justice Frankfurter, you know, I remember, said you can attack a lack of subject matter jurisdiction in the alley or over the back fence or at any time. You can attack it for the first time on appeal. You can attack it at any point in the trial proceeding. You can't waive subject matter jurisdiction, nor can it be granted by any kind of consent or waiver.
Okay, so next question is dismissal without prejudice or with prejudice?
It would be dismissed. It'd be dismissed with prejudice to refiling in Texas unless they reestablished a residence in Texas.
That seems inconsistent with it being subject matter jurisdiction. But anyway, that's...
Any other questions?
Counsel, on Justice Jefferson's point, you're not arguing that the trial court was required to make findings of fact. The statute doesn't say that.
No,
right?
And
you're
your
point is that, at least your argument is that, there's not enough evidence there to constitute a substantial evidence or a significant connection, whether the trial court made a finding or not.
That's right, Justin. There are undisputed facts, and the error that the trial court made is he misapplied the law to undisputed facts.
Thank you, counsel.
May it please the court. I did want to correct my previous statement, the introductory comment to Chapter 152 says 34 states have now adopted UCCJEA. I think I shorted it by two. I did want to respond to the court's concern with shifting here, and I think if we follow Mr. Ferlenz's argument to its logical conclusion, 152.203 that jurisdiction will be lost in that case, and so it would be a chase, and that's what we're trying to avoid. The commentary to Section 152.101 states that the purposes of the Act are to avoid jurisdictional competition and conflicts with courts of other states in matters of child custody, which have in the past resulted in the shifting of children from state to state with harmful effects on their well-being. And also, comment three, the purpose of the Act is to discourage the use of the interstate system for continuing controversies over child custody. And in that case, we would be following Mr. Ferlenza wherever he goes, and I think that's one of the purposes of the statute, to eliminate the old UCCJA rule, which where you would follow them, it was a hard rule, a six-month rule. In response to the pleadings issue that was raised, I think the court points out that there were no special exceptions, and so I think that any argument regarding pleadings were waived. There's a lot of...
Are there any disputed fact issues here, or is it simple application of law to facts? I noticed there was some briefing about credibility determinations, but it doesn't appear that, for our purposes, there's anything more than just undisputed facts.
I think for the most part that's correct. I mean, the transcript is fairly short. I don't think there's any major significant disagreements. I think it's the application and judging the credibility of the witnesses, I think, was our major point on that issue.
But even if you take everything the mother says is true, the question remains, is that significant and substantial? Is that true?
Yes. That's correct. And I think that's another point that the court has brought up, is that whose burden is, what kind of burden the litigants face in that circumstance. And so I don't believe it was our burden once the motion was filed. I think the burden was on Mr. Ferlenza to sort of disprove those things through introduction of his evidence as well. And so I don't know if both parties would have a burden in that circumstance. I think Mr. Ferlenza did come forth with evidence and certain things that would satisfy that. I think our position is that this motion should have been filed at the commencement is consistent with the statute's purpose, which is to avoid this shifting of the case. And I still come back to the commissioner's comment that once jurisdiction establishes at the commencement, which we know is the filing of the first pleading, then the Texas statute kicks in, and that if you have a jurisdictional question, let's get it resolved expeditiously. Let's not go to preparing for a jury trial, hiring psychologists, engaging in this terrible custody battle that always occurs when you have a custody case going to a jury trial. Let's get this resolved and move it to the state.
Well, that would be a good idea, but if people didn't do it, what? It doesn't matter, does it? I mean, that doesn't give the forum state significant contacts and substantial evidence just because somebody else was dilatory.
And I think in that case, if nobody brings it up and the court doesn't bring it up, then it possibly could be waived. And I think that this is in the nature, basically it goes back to the child support matters, personal jurisdiction was necessary in child support. And in custody, they didn't want to make that a personal jurisdiction issue. So this was always treated sort of in the nature of a subject matter jurisdiction challenge, but not absolutely.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. That concludes the argument.